From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We're part of a 21-day fast calling on people to recognize that the worst weapon of mass destruction in Iraq today is the economic sanctions that have killed over a half million children under age five.
Hunger strike. 12 peace activists opposed to UN sanctions against Iraq have begun their vigil outside the U.S. mission to the United Nations. Also, sleazy riders will look at what Congress is now considering before they break. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Federal Appeals Court yesterday rejected the White House's argument that President Clinton's conversations with White House lawyers are shielded from disclosure by attorney-client privilege, clearing the way for independent counsel Kenneth Starr to question Deputy Counsel Bruce Lindsay, one of Clinton's closest confidants. The 2-1 ruling opens the door for prosecutors to question not only Lindsay, but other White House lawyers about their conversations with Clinton relating to Monica Lewinsky. Meanwhile, Starr's office negotiated with Clinton's legal team about the president's compliance with a subpoena requiring he testify this week before the Lewinsky grand jury. No sitting U.S. president has ever been compelled to appear in person before a criminal grand jury, and those close to Clinton acknowledge he hopes to avoid becoming the first. Teamsters President Ron Kerry was expelled yesterday from the National Labor Union he vowed to clean up after a federally appointed board concluded he had closed his eyes to illegal activity that benefited his most recent campaign. The Independent Review Board ousted Kerry on grounds that, as president, he had the responsibility to know that about $1.4 million was illegally diverted from Teamsters funds to assist his close victory over James Hoffa. After the scheme was uncovered, the election was annulled and a new one ordered. This news from Phnom Penh, Cambodia teetered on the brink of renewed crisis today as opposition leaders said their apparent defeat in general elections was due to fraud and they would boycott the new parliament and organize protests. The ruling Cambodian People's Party of government leader Hun Sen claimed a convincing victory in Sunday's voting and called the opposition allegations ridiculous. Given the ruling party's own projections, an opposition boycott would mean a new government would not be able to form due to a constitutional requirement that it be endorsed by two-thirds of the 122-seat National Assembly. The EPA says pesticide makers fed pesticides to human subjects in Britain. This according to documents obtained by the Environmental Working Group. The group has just released a report called The English Patients, documenting such testing. King Cook is with the working group. He described the experiments.
Adult men who volunteered and were paid for the experiment consumed a neurotoxic insecticide called dichlorvos, which had been dissolved in corn oil in a capsule and fed to them under controlled laboratory conditions. Dichlorvos is used to kill flies and caterpillars and other insects. It's used on fruit and vegetable crops, and it's also used in these pest strips.
The Environmental Working Group claims that from its research, it has found no therapeutic use for the experiments. What's more, the study found that people were unaware of what they were being exposed to. The Mexican government said it will investigate complaints of human rights violations against a group of Central American immigrants who were deported by Mexican authorities in garbage trucks. According to Mexican diplomats, authorities arrested 165 Central American immigrants July 19th in the district of La Concordia in the southern state of Chiapas. Among them were 30 Salvadorans. South Africa's Truth Commission today pardoned four men who beat and stabbed visiting American Fulbright scholar Amy Beale to death in a township outside Cape Town in the final months of white rule. Beale was attacked in August 93 while driving three black friends from the university she worked at to their township home. She died on a pavement begging for mercy as her attackers kick-stabbed and stoned her. The Amnesty Committee of Archbishop Desmond Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation Commission said the four young activists killed Beale in the belief that they would further their campaign for freedom from white rule, which ended 8 months later. Bell Atlantic Corporation, the largest of the five regional Bell phone companies, has agreed to buy GTE Corporation, the nation's largest independent local and long-distance phone operator, and a stock deal valued at $52.8 billion. The merger would create a telecommunications behemoth that would control more than a third of the U.S. local phone market and operate in 41 states. Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi spent a fifth day in her car today in a standoff against the military's refusal to let her visit party supporters in a town outside the capital of Rangoon. Also, three nuns of Mother Teresa's order were shot and killed as they left a clinic for the disabled in western Yemen. Police arrested a 25-year-old suspect who, they said, had fought in Bosnia and Afghanistan. They described him as unstable and said he had been treated at the clinic. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's been only a few months since it seemed imminent that the United States was going to bomb Iraq. During that recent crisis, we talked to groups around the country and the world and heard from various peace groups and other organizations about their activism in opposing military strikes. We also heard daily reports from a small group of people who traveled to Iraq in the midst of this crisis, members of the human rights group Voices in the Wilderness. And the resistance to U.S.-UN policy toward Iraq coming from this group continues. Several dozen members of Voices in the Wilderness have begun a three-week fast and vigil across the street from the United States mission to the United Nations to call for the lifting of the devastating sanctions against Iraq, which they say have caused hundreds of thousands of deaths over the last 8 years. But some say that the efforts of groups like Voices in the Wilderness are not aimed at the right power structure. They say the responsibility for the health and medical crises in Iraq are primarily the responsibility of Saddam Hussein, who they say continues to defy UN Security Council and is obstructing the oil for food program. They also say sanctions are a good policy toward Iraq, but that they should not be used as instruments of punishment. We're joined now by one of those people. George Lopez is a fellow at the Kroc Institute for International Peace at the University of Notre Dame. We're also joined in the studio by Kathy Kelly, who's the founder and executive director of Voices in the Wilderness. It's based in Chicago, but she's come to New York to begin that fast and vigil. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, good to be with you both. Kathy, tell us what you're doing now at the United Nations.
Well, we're on day four of an intended 21-day fast and vigil, and we've set up signs and banners that we hope will call attention to that presence there. We also hope very much to be in daily contact through correspondence. We'll drop off letters for both Mr. Richardson and Mr. Butler, begging them, really, in these crucial days, as talks are anticipated in Baghdad August 3rd through 6th, to recognize that the major weapon of mass destruction in Iraq today unquestionably has to be found in ample evidence in the hospitals, particularly in the pediatrics wards, where we ourselves have seen, we've cradled in our arms, children dying. These children can't possibly be held accountable. They're caught between two opposing forces, and they continue to suffer miserably. And so we think the proper response to that is remorse and repentance. It's in that spirit that we join across from the U.S. mission to the U.N.
And you are 12 activists who are
We're 12
part of
here
the fast.
In New York. There are three also in Seattle engaging in a liquids-only fast. In our fast, some are doing liquids, some water only. And then we also have three people in Guadalupe, California. And there are many people planning actions on August 6th through 9th when focusing on the needless deaths of innocents in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They'll state that the best way to commemorate that loss of life is to try to prevent future loss of life in Iraq.
George Lopez, you've done some interesting work around the issue of sanctions. Now, interestingly enough, you are not opposed to the sanctions against Iraq. Can you explain why?
Well, I'm certainly opposed to the suffering of innocents and the kind of experiences that Kathy and Bishop Gumbelton and others have documented. What I'm most concerned about, Amy, is that we have lost the kind of causal dynamic here in trying to figure out the balance between the responsibility of those in the West who've placed sanctions and the death of children in hospitals like those visited by Kathy and others. We're in a situation where, as early as June of 1991, trying to exercise its dual responsibility for controlling weapons of mass destruction and mitigating humanitarian suffering, the Security Council passed the beginnings of what later would be called the Oil for Food Program, in which the Iraqis were given detailed plans of how controlled sales of oil, which would go as high as 5 billion dollars in 6-month periods could be used and should be used for everything from water purification to medicines to humanitarian relief and food supplies. And between the period June 91 and early 96, the Baghdad government found any number of different bureaucratic ways to not implement and sign that accord and consciously deny to its own people the medical supplies needed to preserve the life of children under five. We're in a situation, I believe, where we've tried to take an action as an international community to control the spread of weapons of mass destruction by someone who's demonstrated use of chemical weapons against his own people. And however crude the instrument for so doing, surrounding somebody with a kind of economic straitjacket, their choice in responding to that is fine. I'll hold my own people hostage, and for every baby that dies, you should feel guilty because I've denied them the kind of medical opportunities that you're willing to provide.
Kathy Kelly, your response.
Well, I believe that the oil for food deal as it presently exists still hasn't come anywhere close to meeting the needs of the Iraqi people. I think you'd be aware, George, that Dennis Halliday, the former coordinator of the distribution of oil for food program, medicine and food, resigned in sheer frustration. And I'm sorry, but he didn't blame the Iraqi government for the failure to distribute the food that was purchased through oil for food. Now, I also want you to know that in February and then again in May when I was in Iraq, members of the WHO, including their director, that's the World Health Organization, and also Holbrook Arthur of the Food and Agriculture Organization, assured us that the Iraqis get an A rating for the distribution of food and medicine purchased under Resolution 986. In fact, Holbrook Arthur said it works like a Swiss watch. They're holding up the Iraqi program of distribution as an example for other third world countries to use. Now, it seems to me, though, that what we need to recognize is that oil prices have fallen. They've been halved since the beginning of this year. And so as the Iraqis try to pull more oil out of the ground in order to be able to meet the $5.2 billion that they're now allowed to sell, they just can't do it unless they get the spare parts, the equipment, in order to repair their oil refineries. Now, this isn't happening. And in our July delegation that went, people returned saying they went to Iraq in July, and they returned saying that not a single contract had yet been approved for spare parts so that the Iraqis can begin to pump the oil that would allow them to purchase the desperately needed foods and medicines.
Do they have the ability to sell and generate $5.2 billion worth of oil?
No, at the moment they clearly don't. They might be able to get up to $4 billion, but they've got to have these spare parts. And if they continue to overuse refineries and oil processing places without being able to open up new ones, then they'll eventually cause irreparable damage to their own oil refining places. Now,
what's the trigger that would permit that?
What is the trigger that would permit the Iraqis to be able to get the spare parts they need? U.S. signatures on the contracts. Not a single contract has yet been approved. And these are bureaucratic delays.
Or the opening of the doors of four specific palaces where we have pretty good knowledge of biological and chemical weapons.
No, I don't think that's true, George. I think that, in fact, the palaces have been opened and the inspectors that went into those palaces came out and said, well, we didn't find anything. Now, if you want evidence of biological weaponry being used in Iraq, it's not hard to find. You can just go to the south of Iraq, go to Basra, go to Amara. You'll see that sewage and raw waste, feces, are being dumped into the water that flows into southern Iraq. This is biological warfare. This is causing typhus, diarrhea, malaria, cholera, terrible diseases that are robbing the lives of tiny Iraqi children who, again, can't possibly be held accountable. And so I think we need to understand in the United States that perhaps the United States possibly isn't really at all interested in eliminating weapons of mass destruction. Rather, what it's all about is proliferating weapons of mass destruction, the United States being able to sell its weaponry to other countries in the region. And as long as Saddam Hussein is in place, crippled, but in place, he's a good excuse to keep these sanctions on. And as long as the sanctions are in place, Iraq's competitors in the oil market will be able to have much higher revenue for their products. And then the Saudis, for instance, will be able to purchase our top crop, and that's weapons.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly, who is the head of Voices in the Wilderness, here with a group of 11 other people who are on a vigil and fast in front of the U.S. mission to the United Nations protesting the sanctions against Iraq. On the phone with us is George Lopez, and he is with the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace at the University of Notre Dame, has written a few interesting articles, one of them called Pain and Promise, in which they talk, he and David Courtwright, about the impact of sanctions and that they are not opposed to sanctions against Iraq. Now, Kathy Kelly, I wanted to ask you about how sanctions have developed. It's interesting now there's corporations have unified against sanctions because it hurts corporate profits to have sanctions against any country. We see it with USA Engage, for example, against Cuba. So you have interesting bedfellows of the corporate community and progressives who want to see sanctions lifted. And you see a number of sanctions all over the world against countries. People credit sanctions with bringing down the apartheid regime in South Africa as a peaceful way to go after a government. Now, you argue that sanctions are not peaceful.
I think it's important for people not to presume that sanctions are a nonviolent means to accomplish social change. If these sanctions are hitting the poorest of the people in a country, it's not just a pinch, it's a wallop. It causes people without jobs to be idled. It causes people not to be able to purchase their most essential goods. And so I think we have to look at the human rights of the people who are being directly affected by these sanctions. The sanctions that were leveled against South Africa had a very big impact on large, rich corporations. But the sanctions that have been leveled against Iraq have clearly had very little effect on Iraq's government. I mean, we're looking at 8 years, and the Iraqi government is still withstanding the sanctions. We're also looking at a situation in which President Clinton and Madeleine Albright have clearly stated that the sanctions won't be lifted as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. And so there's no point for the Iraqi people in thinking that if they somehow were to oust their current government, that the sanctions would be lifted. So there's no incentive for Iraq's people.
There was a scathing article in the New York Times yesterday by Barbara Crosset called Iraq Might Be Tempted to End Oil for Food Plan, and blaming what has happened in Iraq on Saddam Hussein, saying that he's the one who's ending even food and medicine coming into Iraq to intensify the problem so that the world will finally lift the sanctions. Do you place any blame on Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think the Iraqi people are in a horribly frustrating situation. With regard to that idea that Iraq might not want to continue the oil for food program and continue charitable donations from other countries, I think I can understand that the Iraqis would take umbrage at the idea that, for instance, Saudi Arabia might be able to ship charitable donations to Iraq and Kuwait also, when in fact the reason they have the wherewithal to make those charitable donations is because the Iraqi oil isn't on the market. Now, with regard to who's to blame, at this point, I don't think it makes any sense to keep on trying to ask whether the major criminal activity is being pursued by Saddam Hussein or whether it's being pursued by the U.S. administration. I think the major critical question right now is how can we alleviate the suffering that's being imposed on innocent children? And that happens day in and day out as we talk about, you know, who's to blame. Certainly the United States, recognizing the toll of the sanctions, recognizing the civilian suffering, has to recognize that there must be another way to accomplish its stated goals.
George Lopez, you've done a lot of work on sanctions. Can you talk further about how you see sanctions working and not working?
Well, you referred to the Pain and Promise article, Amy. I think it's important to see there that what David and I were trying to do was, in some respects, in agreement with Kathy and others, and that is to suggest that at the first and most important level, you can't use a sanctions policy as a blunt instrument against a whole population. You must use it as a kind of targeted and issue-specific strategy to extract certain concessions from a particular kind of recalcitrant regime. And at least some of us believe in a sort of halfway or more than halfway point between the blanket dropping of sanctions and their continued maintenance as a measurement for punishment. What we saw as useful is various times in 1994 to the period 1997, where we might have acknowledged some begrudging but still real concessions by the Iraqi government that could have eased portions of the trade sanctions in some of the sectors that Kathy talked about, and reframe from a kind of movement to the goalposts that she's also rightly referred to by particularly by Secretary of State Albright. The UN, as an international community and kind of collective moral authority, is a group that tried to constrain weapons of mass destruction in a dictator with a demonstrated record of use. That's what we're trying to get to in sanctions, is constraining the options of someone who has no qualms about use of these weapons against his own people and presumably others because of their continued production, and not to hold the people of Iraq hostage thereby, but to change the choices Saddam himself will have for the allocation of resources. I mean, it's instructive that inside Iraq, supporters of the Ba'ath Party and members of the Republican Guard are not the people that are starving. And we're caught in a sort of very difficult moral dilemma here. We have what I consider the equivalent of somebody in the Red Schoolhouse who is building interesting chemical experiments and bombs with a group of children sitting in the classroom, tells the international community it's their responsibility to feed these people. And by the way, after you leave the sandwiches at the door, don't look at me and see how I distribute those and go away, because I'd like to now wreak havoc elsewhere.
I'm going to let stations break to identify themselves, and then we'll come back and get final comment from you, George Lopez, fellow at the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace at the University of Notre Dame, and Kathy Kelly with Voices in the Wilderness, based in Chicago, here in New York, for a three-week hunger fast protesting the UN-US sanctions against Iraq. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we wrap up this discussion on sanctions against Iraq and should they continue. Our guest, Kathy Kelly, longtime activist around the issue of Iraq, has been to Iraq many times, the last trip this past May. And she is in New York, part of a vigil and hunger fast against the U.S.-UN sanctions against Iraq. On the phone with us is George Lopez. He's at the University of Notre Dame, the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace. Interesting. Joan Kroc is the wife of the founder of McDonald's. Is that right, George?
Yes, she is, and has done a great deal to try to educate people about the dangers of nuclear proliferation and options for peace and justice in a Gandhian and other tradition.
Well, Kathy Kelly, George Lopez had spoken before the break about who really gets hurt by the sanctions and that it's not Saddam Hussein and the officials and the Ba'ath Party.
Well, George had used an interesting analogy, but let me propose another one. Suppose that a person believes that unquestionably Saddam Hussein is as villainous as he's been demonized to be in the U.S. press. Now, liken this to a hijacker or a group of hijackers who take a plane into dangerous straits. Would you recommend that because you want to punish these hijackers, you should blast the whole plane and every passenger and every cabin crew member in it? I know most people would say, no, don't do that. Negotiate. Try to effect persuasion. Try to accomplish some kind of a deal wherein the innocent people's lives will be saved. And what we're saying is that if you really believe in nonviolence, and I know many of the listeners to this show do, then you know that when somebody is desperate, you don't back them into a corner and make them more desperate. We're advocating diplomacy, negotiation, persuasion. We're advocating United States people saying, look, we'd rather have fair trade exchanges with the Iraqi people, even if that means that we consume less oil in this country or that we have to pay a higher price for it, that we really want to see actions that would allow for Iraqi people to live. And no longer do we want to be responsible for the horrendous death and suffering that happens in that country.
What's your response to this latest news? And the Times today, the New York Times, nuclear suspicions cling to Iraq in latest report. And it says 7 years after Iraq pledged to dismantle its nuclear weapons program, international inspectors still suspect that it may be hiding the documents, equipment, and material needed to make an atomic weapon. And it goes on to say that the International Atomic Energy Agency, in a report to the UN Security Council, said yesterday it's found no evidence that Iraq has nuclear weapons, but the agency says Iraq's failure to account for key nuclear equipment and blueprints left open the possibility it had hidden the expertise and material for future use.
I think it should disturb all of us that any country has the potential possibly to develop a nuclear weapon. I think probably the response of many people in the Middle East will be, hey, wait a minute, Israel has 200 to 300 thermonuclear weapons. But with regard to Iraq, you know, later in that article, it refers to the possibility that scientists, gifted scientists, might still have in their brains the know-how to produce nuclear weapons. Well, are we recommending that they all be given lobotomies? It also says in that article that there are unnamed foreign intelligence officials who have come up with I want to know the names of those people. It talks about an American official. Let's get the names out there. Let's get hard, concrete data. Let's assure that when these allegations are made, we also hear the Iraqi government's official response. I mean, Ambassador Nizar Hamdoun's not that far away from the person who wrote that article. So I felt a little bit disturbed that every time it looks like Iraq might be moving closer to a lifting of the sanctions, you can predictably, reliably count on another a charge to come forth that says, stop, wait, don't lift the sanctions. The editorial in today's New York Times says, don't fund covert operations to oust Saddam Hussein. I think that lends transparency, that the United States does not want Saddam Hussein out of power. They want him there, crippled, as an excuse to keep Iraqi oil off the market.
George Lopez, a final comment.
I think it's very important to realize that at some point we have to recognize that general deterrence and the success of the sanctions effort to uncover most of the weapons and plans for mass destruction permit us to take off in a limited way sanctions that will constrain the production that will lead to greater humanitarian positive impact for the Iraqi people. On that, Kathy and I agree. I think what we have to be very, very cautious of is the manipulation of the oil market and manipulation of oil futures by Saddam Hussein in ways that have really stifled the oil-for-food deal up to this point. And we not be naive about the extent to which we need to aggressively continue to pursue some of these revelations about the development of nuclear and chemical weapons. That's the advantage of the stick combined with the carrot that sanctions give us.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Kathy Kelly at Voices in the Wilderness. If people want to get in touch with your group, where can they call?
We hope they'll call 773-784-8065. That's a Chicago number. Please understand that most of us are here in New York fasting across from the U.S. mission to the U.N., but we'll pick up messages and be glad to get right back in touch.
Again, that number?
773-784-8065. And we have a website also at www.nonviolence.org/VITW.
That's www.nonviolence.org/VITW, Voices in the Wilderness. And George Lopez with the Kroc Institute for International Peace at the University of Notre Dame. Is there a number you'd like to give out? Your article, Pain and Promise, Trouble in the Gulf, appears in the May-June issue of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
The Center for Distribution of this and many of our other sanctions materials is 1-800-233-6786.
One more time.
1-800-233-6786.
Thanks both very much for being with us. We're going to take a short musical break, and when we come back, we're going to go down to Washington and look at what's happening in this frenzied last week of negotiations that are taking place in Congress around sleazy riders and other bills. So do stay with us.
The Remember, Congress members once were liberal democratic.
Our banks were wrecks.
We bounced our checks.
Our morals were erratic.
Then voters came and slapped the blame. The changes were dramatic.
You traded radic liberals for a new breed of fanatic. Super callous, mean, and nasty right-wing legislation.
We're gonna block all progress.
Clinton's term is in stagnation.
He'll rise again, but only when we recess for vacation.
From super callous, mean, and nasty right-wing legislation.
Lum-de-li-li-lum-de-li. We have a plan.
It's on C-SPAN.
We know you'll be enthralled.
So our contract with America is airing on Geraldo.
It has a secret message.
To decipher what it's called, go and read the slogan backwards. It's a lot like finding Waldo. Noisy newts, white men in suits give you the jeepers creepers.
Of all the recent congresses, this one could be the cheapest.
Push people off the public trough.
Our cuts could be the deepest.
We'll take a bet that you'll forget
you do not have to keep us.
The Capitol Steps from their CD, A Whole Newt World. That song, Super Callous, Mean, and Nasty Right-Wing Legislation. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Legislators of both parties use and abuse the practice of attaching controversial proposals called riders to must-pass federal legislation, such as appropriations bills. In these last 2 weeks before the House takes its summer recess, legislation is being railroaded right and left, well, mainly right. Republicans who have failed in several frontal assaults on laws protecting the environment, reproductive rights, and equal opportunity for gay men and lesbians are trying to chip away at them through these backdoor machinations. Few of these measures would survive the legislative process on their own merits, which is precisely why they've been packaged as riders. Riders can pass through the appropriations process without subjecting the topics to full review. On the environmental front, there are at least 20 riders attached to the Senate Interior Appropriations Bill that activists say will destroy wilderness protection, pave over parks, promote clear-cutting of forests. Meanwhile, there's a rider attached to a bill in the House that would prohibit federal funds from going to localities that require companies to provide health benefits to unmarried domestic partners of employees, clearly geared at gay partners. We're joined right now by several people who are usually on the Hill, probably headed there right now to lobby. We're going to talk with the Human Rights Campaign, the Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Group. We're going to speak with the U.S. PIRG that is dealing with environmental legislation on the Hill, and with Planned Parenthood looking at the issue of abortion and what's happening there in Congress. We first turn to Nancy Burmeier, Senior Policy Analyst with the Human Rights Campaign. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nancy. Nancy, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Can you tell us what is being considered on the Hill today as we speak?
Well, it's not exactly clear whether they're going to get to legislative action today or not because of the shootings of the officers. But as soon as they do turn to that, they're going to actually look at two different riders that affect the lesbian and gay community. One is the one you mentioned. It's called the Riggs Amendment, which would basically punish San Francisco for having a policy that requires their contractors to offer domestic partnership benefits. The other is an amendment called the Heffley Amendment, which would repeal a recent executive order by the president, which basically says that in federal employment there will be no discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Mr. Heffley is trying to undo that executive order.
Can you talk about other legislation?
Well, there'll be a number of spending bills that will go through Congress. They're very large, complex legislation. There'll be one coming up sometime in the coming weeks or months for the District of Columbia, which will also probably have some anti-gay things on it, as it usually does. But, you know, there'll be those two amendments for sure probably this week and some stuff coming up on the District of Columbia bill in the next couple of weeks.
You know, when people talk about conservatives, you usually think states' rights. But it seems that clearly states' rights are violated when you have the federal government saying no federal funding for cities or states that make a decision about something like, for example, domestic partner policies.
Absolutely. It's a clear violation of local control, which has been a mantra of particularly this Congress to sort of get federal government out of local decision making. And yet, here's a case where clearly Representative Riggs has geared his amendment to punish one city for taking a stand that he personally disagrees with. And we're hopeful that we'll be able to try and fight this back in the next day or so.
There's also interesting legislation. Now, this is not at the congressional level, but since we have you on the line, I'm interested in two other issues. One is what's taking place in Hawaii, which is coming up, though it's not in the next week.
Right. In Hawaii, as many people know, this Hawaii court is considering a lawsuit that would allow same-sex couples access to the same marriage rights that everyone else enjoys. They're very close to finishing that court decision. It's the final stages of it. We're just waiting for the Supreme Court to rule. To try and undo that decision, the legislature put an amendment to the Constitution, to the state Constitution, on the ballot for this November. So rather than allow gay people the access to the same rights everyone else has, they're going to try to amend their Constitution to put an explicit exemption for gay marriage, or give basically gives the legislature the power to do that. So we've been fighting very hard to try and defeat that and to say, you know, you shouldn't be amending your Constitution to allow discrimination against a particular group of people. That's contrary to what constitutions are written for.
Now I wanted to address the issue that has happened in the last few weeks around ads. It seemed to all start with the Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott, talking about, well, comparing gays to kleptomaniacs.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, and it seems like a kind of concerted campaign, was followed up by these series of ads in newspapers. Can you describe what those ads said, where they came from, and how they fit into the legislative process?
Yeah, I think it's no mistake that those ads ran at the time that they did, just as we were beginning to consider some of this legislation on the House side in particular. Those ads basically were putting forward the notion that you don't have to be gay, it's a choice, we can fix you, there's something wrong with you, and if you just come and find Christ, basically, because it's all very Christian-based, we will make you better again, sort of furthering that notion that there is something wrong with people who are lesbian or gay. There were three in a row that appeared in major newspapers. I think they continue to run them. And they're being run by a coalition of right-wing organizations like the Christian Coalition, like the Family Research Council, like Focus on the Family, people who have long-standing records of opposing any kind of policy of fairness for lesbian and gay people. We have tried to respond to that by putting an ad out in response that says, you know, families are whole and healthy who have gay people in them. Gay people are happy. You know, they certainly face discrimination in this nation and need to have that addressed, but it's not about being gay that they have issues. It's about the way society treats them.
Is it true? I think it was in Frank Rich's column in the New York Times a couple Saturdays ago where he talked about the head of the organization that was behind that ad going off to be with his gay lover.
There are, yes, I have heard that as well. I don't know how true it is, but I understand that the people who, two of the men who actually founded Exodus, which is this notion that you can come out of homosexuality, is the terms that they use, that the two of the men who were like in early founders ran off together. I actually don't know the veracity of that, but I know that rumor is out there.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think it's interesting to note too, when you mentioned Lott's comments, that has ramifications for. Not only the real life, the messages that go out to people in the world about what it means to be gay and whether it's okay or not, but there's a man whose nomination is pending right now in the United States Senate, James Hormel, has been nominated to be ambassador to Luxembourg. He happens to be openly gay, and because of that, two or three senators have basically stopped his nomination. We have more than enough committed votes to actually confirm him, but because of the way the Senate works and because of Senator Lott, that has been stopped in its tracks. And this man who is well qualified, who has been approved by the committee, has not even had an opportunity for open debate on the floor of the Senate because of the homophobia of certain members of the Senate.
Has he testified before the committee?
He has not only testified before the committee, he's been confirmed by the Senate before to represent the U.S. as an alternate to the United Nations. He had his hearing. He was confirmed 16-2 by the Senate committee, which, by the way, is chaired by Senator Helms, who's no friend of the community. So you know that this man is very well qualified. And it has been, as he was to go through the final step, the final confirmation on the floor of the Senate, that three members have put holds on him, and Senator Lott has refused to schedule any time for that final debate, even though we have 60 votes confirmed to vote for him, more than enough to confirm him.
Well, Nancy Burmeier, I want to thank you very much for joining us. If people want to keep tabs on what's happening in Congress in this last week, where can they call or where can they go on the web?
Two places. You can call our office, which is the phone number is 202-628-4160.
One more time.
202-628-4160. Or they can go to our website, which is kept very up to date, particularly on things like the Heffley Amendment and the Riggs Amendment, and that's www.hrc.org.
Again, Nancy Burmeier, Senior Policy Analyst with the Human Rights Campaign. Thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Washington as she heads off to Congress.
Thank you very much, Amy. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Planned Parenthood, Federation of America, and U.S. PIRG to talk about the various riders that affect their constituencies. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, where citizen action counts most. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined now by Anna Aurelio from U.S. Public Interest Research Group and Estelle Rogers, who's the Legislative Director for Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Before we talk about Congress, Estelle Rogers, I understand that your website was just hacked. Is that
true? You know, that's news to me. I was actually just looking for our website address so that I could give it to the listeners. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, I have heard it. Actually, I've heard it in the past happening on countries like Indonesia, where activists get in and they end up having links to genocide in East Timor. Now I've heard that it happened with the PPFA.org site, where it gives you links to anti-abortion groups.
Well, actually, that may be the reason that our website address has changed, so maybe I'll take this opportunity to clarify that. I think that was our old website address, and it may be as a result of that we have a new one. And let me, could I give that
sure.
to your listeners?
Uh-huh.
It's www.plannedparenthood, all one word, .org.
That's www.plannedparenthood.org. Estelle Rogers, why don't you tell us what is going on in Congress right now? We're talking about these riders. Often bills would not pass if they stood alone, but they're put into bills that have to be passed, and people don't even quite realize that they've been attached to those bills.
That's right. Every year, Congress has to act on 13 different appropriations bills for different departments of the federal government. Some of them more well-known than others, but there are 13. And this year, I was actually, when I was listening to Nancy talk about the riders that the gay rights community was dealing with, I almost felt myself being envious that she only had two or three, because I've counted in preparation for coming on this morning six major bills on which there are anti-choice or anti-family planning riders, and also one authorization bill, the Department of Defense authorization bill, over and above that. And that's, I don't mean to be competitive with Nancy. She does a great job, and it's an incredible organization that's fighting an awful lot of battles, so don't get me wrong. But in addition to our appropriations fights, we've also got two other major freestanding pieces of legislation that we're fighting at the same time. So it's a pretty heavy-duty defensive fight right now, and that's in the face of some affirmative agenda items we're also trying to push that sometimes just get pushed to the back burner.
This is a program that's not afraid to name names. Can you talk about the best friends for the issue of women's choice and your worst enemies in Congress right now?
Well, I hate to offend anybody I'm leaving out. There are a number of people who come to mind as best friends. Nita Lowey on the House side is certainly one. Rosa DeLauro is another. Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut. I shouldn't be so regional about it. Nancy Pelosi of California is also a very close friend of ours. Diana DeGette, a new member of Congress from Colorado, who's fabulous. And I shouldn't leave out the men. Jim Greenwood, a progressive Republican of Pennsylvania, has been a wonderful friend, just as one example. That's on the House side. On the Senate side, Olympia Snow of Maine has been very steadfast, and Jim Jeffords of Vermont, again, two moderate Republicans who in these days in Congress become extremely important, of course, because the Republicans are in the leadership and control the committees. So if we can find friends among the Republican ranks, we're in much better shape than if we had none. Senator Kennedy should absolutely be mentioned. He's been an incredible ally. And I think rather than make big mistakes, let me also mention Senator Feinstein of California. And there are others. Senator Leahy of Vermont has been extremely vigorous lately on the Senate Judiciary Committee on a very difficult bill. I think that's probably as far as I should go right now. In terms of enemies, there are just so many, and they keep coming out of the woodwork. There's some of the members of the House who are famous, actually more famous for other things, but Ernest Istook of Oklahoma is one who, in addition to all his other distinctions, has authored some major anti-family planning amendments to the currently pending labor HHS appropriations bill that would force young women who want birth control services at Title X family planning clinics to get parental consent for those birth control services. I find it very ironic in a community that decries the teen pregnancy rate that they make contraception so hard to get for young women who really want to act responsibly. So that's the beginning of my enemies list. Actually, we've had a new one come to the fore this year, and that's Tom Coburn, also of Oklahoma, who is a physician in the House of Representatives and who was creative enough to author an amendment to the Agriculture Appropriations Bill, of all things, that would prohibit the Food and Drug Administration, which whose budget is controlled by the Agriculture Bill, from approving mifepristone, which is also known as RU486, which is a medical method of abortion early in pregnancy. So it's the first time that the House has voted, and this amendment was passed in the House, the first time that this House has voted to actually intervene in the FDA approval process for a particular drug.
You know, I'm interested, Estelle Rogers, in the whole issue of the terrorist who's in North Carolina?
In North Carolina.
Eric Rudolph.
In the Western Woods.
The man who the authorities believe may have been responsible for the Atlanta bombing, as well as the bombing of the women's health clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. There are some who are wearing T-shirts that say "Run, Eric, Run," but I would think that the pro-choice forces in Congress could be using this as a way to go after those who are fighting against the issue of choice. And I haven't seen it really come up in the discussion in Congress. I mean, it's a very graphic case, a man who killed a police officer, right? The last women's health clinic that was bombed killed a security officer who was an off-duty cop and also maimed a nurse who worked there, what happened in Atlanta. But they're sort of two separate issues, and I don't hear them come together to talk about.
Well, I think you're right. The issue of violence and how pervasive it is actually against reproductive health centers has probably not gotten the coverage it deserves. I think it's one of these things where every time there is a really major incident that results in death or severe injury, which it did in this Birmingham bombing, it gets a lot of press, and this manhunt obviously has been quite a press hit. But it sort of ignores the fact that on a daily basis, reproductive health centers face all kinds of harassment and defacing of their property, There have been, in recent months, a number of butyric acid attacks, which is this noxious acid that seeps into the facility and has a smell that actually I've never had the misfortune of being there at the time, but has this smell that often forces them to clear out the place for days on end. And it is, you know, it is one direct way of trying to restrict access to reproductive health services. And the analog in Congress is they try to find all sorts of other ways. If it doesn't work by shutting down the place, they try to find other ways to make them go out of business or make people less able to access services. Hmm. So I think there is really a connection, and you're right. It has not been the political issue it should be.
And today there's going to be a major memorial service, I know, at the Capitol with the president and probably most Congress members around the two Capitol police officers who were killed defending the Capitol. But you hear that, you know, condemned by all Congress members coming out. But you don't hear that kind of condemnation by those very same Congress members of this guy, Eric Rudolph, who is on the loose in the mountains.
Well, yeah, I just want to say that we haven't tried or convicted Eric Rudolph yet, so I don't want to prejudge the issue. But I do think that there is this feeling about the reproductive health community, about abortion clinics, which are always sort of, that term is said with disdain, that this is sort of, you know, the far frontiers of the health community, or it's not really part of the health community at all. I mean, if people shot up hospitals, I think the hue and cry would be a whole lot different than people shooting up a, quote, abortion clinic, unquote.
We're talking to Stelle Rogers, Legislative Director for Planned Parenthood Federation of America. They've been quite busy on the Hill dealing with this last week of frenzied legislation. And as I said, Anna Aurelio is with us, staff scientist with USPIRG. What have you been focusing on in this last week, Anna?
Well, I would say last week has probably been the busiest week for the public interest research groups when it comes to fighting off the rollback of our environmental laws. What we've seen is, as you said, Congress is very, very afraid and hasn't been that successful actually lately at passing standalone bills which would roll back our environmental laws. In fact, this spring, the public interest community won for the first time in 9 years a vote against the timber industry when Congressman Bob Smith tried to pass a clear-cut forest bill under the name of Forest Health, and we defeated that bill. So they haven't been that successful in doing that, and so instead what they've focused on is attaching these anti-environmental riders to spending bills. The only thing that Congress has to do every single year is spend our money. And so it's very, very difficult to try and get some of these bad anti-environmental provisions off these bills. What we fought last week was a bill that funds not only Veterans Administration and Housing and Urban Development, but also the Environmental Protection Agency. And there were a series of anti-environmental provisions on that bill that really reflected the influence that big business has on the Congress, in particular big polluters.
Talk more specifically, and isn't there line item veto now authority that the president has to take out particular riders that get passed, put on appropriations bills?
Well, actually, that authority has been challenged by the courts, and also my understanding is that it applies to spending, only money, not legislative provisions.
Uh-huh.
So let me tell you a little bit about what Congress tried to do last week and actually may succeed unless the president vetoes this VA HUD bill. There were riders on the EPA spending bill that one of the riders actually was a big gift to General Electric. Now, General Electric is a company that Business Week has called in the past the largest company in the world. General Electric is also a company that by spilling PCBs into several rivers around the country has rendered the fish in these rivers unfit to eat. PCBs are a known animal carcinogen and a probable human carcinogen. They accumulate in people's fat, and it's very difficult to actually find a person in the United States that doesn't carry some of this toxic chemical in their body fat. So they're very, very dangerous chemicals. They're not being used anymore, but they last a long time. They were designed to last a long time. General Electric doesn't want to have to clean up its mess now, even though it makes billions of dollars of profits every single year. Jack Welch, its CEO, who also is handsomely compensated, doesn't want to have to clean up the rivers that it has polluted. And so the first rider on the VA HUD bill was one which would actually stop EPA from cleaning up and ordering General Electric to clean up the mess that it has made. The second special deal for special interest riders was to stop EPA from even monitoring mercury emissions from power plants. Mercury is a neurologic and reproductive toxicant. Again, it builds up in people's fat. It renders fish unsafe to eat. Fish in 50,000 bodies of water in the U.S. are unsafe to eat because of mercury. And a big major, the last major uncontrolled industrial source of mercury is coal-fired power plants. And EPA wanted to even just start monitoring this problem. And so there was a rider attached to this bill that would stop EPA from even going forward with figuring out exactly how much comes out of a particular power plant. There were several other riders. One would gag EPA from even talking about global warming. That one was actually removed. A successful vote, an amendment by Representative Obie stripped that rider. But then there's also another piece of that rider that was not removed that said EPA can't do anything in terms of programs or spending money to deal with global climate change that would be in contemplation of the Kyoto Protocol to limit greenhouse gas emissions. So there was a host of anti-environmental riders on this bill. Unfortunately, only one piece of them got stripped out. There was an amendment offered by Congressman Henry Waxman from California that failed, did not succeed, did not pass last week, to strip the rest of these riders out. And if this bill goes forward, this is going to stop EPA from doing its job to protect the public's health. And it's going to benefit the big coal-fired power plants, General Electric, and other major polluters that are threatening our public health.
As you look at the legislative process now in this last week, and I put this question to either of you, does it make you think about things that you think need to be changed in the system, aside from just changing people who are sitting in those seats in Congress?
Well, PERG has been fighting for getting the big money out of politics. If you look at these anti-environmental riders, and we're actually anticipating a big fight on the Senate Interior Appropriations Bill, there's 18 to 20 anti-environmental riders on that bill that would benefit big oil mining, timber, ranching, you name it. If you gave a lot of money to Congress, chances are you're getting a special deal on that bill. So we have been fighting to clean up campaign finances, get the big money out of politics, and we really feel that has to be a priority if Congress is going to stop bowing to big polluters and protect the public health.
Let me also mention another change in the system on a different level, and that is the thought has occurred to me over the last couple of weeks and to many of us who have watched this system for years that the rushed and sort of precipitous way that a lot of these issues get heard and debated, and those are both euphemisms or gross exaggerations of what really happens in Congress in the waning days before any recess, is just a real disservice to the American public. And there are occasionally brave members of Congress who literally get up on the floor and say, we never heard about this in subcommittee, we never heard about this in committee, you can't just bring this up now, nobody has a chance to deal with it. A great example of that was this Coburn Amendment about FDA and their
we have to wrap
ban
up.
On... Okay, thanks.
Well, we just have to wrap up, but you could just finish your thought very quickly.
Well, I just think that there is a real lack of thoughtfulness and deliberation in these bodies that are supposed to be deliberative bodies, and I think the American people are ill-served by that.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. Estelle Rogers from Planned Parenthood, their website, www.plannedparenthood.org. And also thank you to Anna Aurelio from the U.S. PERG, their website, www.perg.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee Soo Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Engineer in Washington is Joe Gill. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!